Our next speaker is Justice Jared Tufte, who was elected to a 10-year term on the North Dakota Supreme Court in 2016. Before serving on the Supreme Court, Justice Tufte was a district court judge in the Southeast Judicial District with chambers in Valley City. From 2011 to 2014, he served as legal counsel to Governor Jack Dalrymple. During his time at the governor's office, he was also a senior policy advisor to the governor with a portfolio including tribal-state relations, courts, corrections, workforce safety, emergency management, and energy issues. A native North Dakotan, Justice Tufte grew up in Grand Forks and West Fargo. His undergraduate education was in computer engineering and economics at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland, Ohio. After working as a software engineer for Motorola on its cellular telephone network equipment, he earned a law degree from Arizona State University, graduating first in his class. Following law school, Jared served as a law clerk to Judge Roger Woolman on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. He and his wife, Mai Lin, have three children. Justice Tufte wrote a companion article for the symposium issue of the North Dakota Law Review out later this fall. It is titled, The North Dakota Constitution, An Original Approach Since 1889. He will be presenting on that same topic today. Welcome, Justice Tufte.
Thank you. I guess that was the long version of my bio. Apologies to the audience that had to listen to so many details. Just as an introductory point, I'm using a slide service that those of you who are not here in person can follow along online. I know we will have a camera trained on the screen here, but some of the slides have a little more text in than the professionals recommend. And so if you want to log a separate browser window into slides.com/Tufte/deck/live, you can have a live shot of my slides that will advance as I advance the slides here in the room. You certainly want to keep the YouTube screen up if you want to participate in the comments. So first, thank you to the board, both outgoing and incoming, for inviting me to participate. I probably would not have been motivated to ask and research some of the questions that came together into this article and my talk here today if I hadn't been prompted to give some thought to participating. So thank you for asking me to do that. Thank you to Nick Samuelson, my most recent clerk who's now out in the real world of practicing lawyers. And it's as a fairly new judge, it's always fun to see your clerks active and participating. And so it's fun to see him participating here along with me on the same panel. So my talk here today, as I said, will largely track my forthcoming article. It's simple in concept. And really, it's a question that I found myself asking as I was a newer member of the court, coming to that job with some ideas about how I think constitutional issues ought to be approached. But I think any fair-minded person wants to ask, well, how has this institution that I've become a part of interpreted the state constitution, and what's our history and tradition and primary mode for interpreting constitutional issues, and is my initial take on what the right approach is consistent or inconsistent with what the court's done, both in the early days of statehood and more recently. And sort of secondary to that, I asked along those lines, what sort of arguments, what sort of sources and methods have resonated with the court when approaching our own unique constitution, and to what extent are those things that are maybe a lost art in some respects, based on some of the arguments I've seen in a few of the cases that have been before the court, especially in those early months and first year or two. So I'll close today with based on my historical kind of empirical look at what the court's done in terms of its approach, with a few thoughts for things that an advocate wants to make sure that he or she addresses in presenting issues relating to the North Dakota Constitution that aren't well developed in the case law that we have. So try to be precise in my speech and lay out a couple of definitions, because some of these terms are things that people use in different ways. Different scholars, even focusing on constitutional interpretation issues, will sometimes use these terms in different ways. And so I'll just lay out what I mean by a couple of these terms before I get too far into the discussion. So originalism. Quite a variety of scholars that work on mainly federal constitutional issues and scholarship and interpretation One is from our neighboring state of Minnesota, Michael Stokes Paulson. This isn't by any means the only definition of originalism, but it's one that I think is pretty complete and fairly nuanced articulation of at least one thoughtful scholar takes the term to mean. And so he says that originalism is the task of constitutional interpretation is to accurately ascertain and then faithfully apply as law the objective original public meaning of the words and phrases of the Constitution as a written legal instrument, that is, the meaning that the words and phrases would have had to a reasonably informed speaker and reader of the English language at the time the text was adopted, considering the structure of the document and specialized uses of any terms of art. So there's a lot in there, and I don't intend to parse through all the nuances or discuss some of the competing definitions. I would just note at this point that some flavors of originalism speak in terms of original intentions rather than original meaning, sometimes caricatured as getting out a Ouija board and trying to channel the framers about what they really thought this meant or how it would apply in the real world. Modern originalism would tend to focus more on original meaning. And I would also note, as you see, a photograph from the announcement of the filing of the Victims' Rights Amendment here just a few years ago. Originalism is not just about interpreting old texts. These are tools that apply just as well to something enacted 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. They may apply differently because, as we'll get into it, originalism in part was an interpretive approach developed and articulated and elaborated to address problems when language evolves over time and older provisions may not carry the same meaning that they do to a modern speaker or reader of the language. And so distilling it down, in order for me to assess what our court has said it's doing in terms of constitutional interpretation and whether or not that overlaps or coincides with originalism, I'm quoting Randy Barnett and Evan Burnick here, that the core requirements of originalism are, one, the meaning of a provision of the Constitution was fixed at the time it was enacted, and they'll call this the fixation thesis, and two, that fixed meaning ought to constrain constitutional decision makers today, and they'll refer to that as the constraint principle. And so for purposes of my paper and our discussion today, I break out into a separate third element, that the thing that is fixed and the thing that constrains is the original meaning of the constitutional text. The original meaning aspect is somewhat implicit in both of those two elements, the way Barnett and Burnick frame it. So what are the competing interpretive theories? There's a variety of them. For my purposes, I'll take any of these, living constitutionalism, purposivism, common law constitutionalism, as rejecting one or both of fixation or constraint. They either dramatically qualify or reject categorically some aspect of those core elements of originalism. And then one other side point as sort of a point of introduction. Originalism versus non-originalism is, in sort of the legal commentary and some of the popular press, often portrayed as a left versus right political axis kind of a division. And I'd just like to point out at the beginning that's not at all universal either. You could point to recent writings from Professor Adrian Vermeule, who's on the political right and who's rejected originalism as being inconsistent or insufficiently advancing what he views as the proper constitutional interpretation. On the left, political left, you'll find originalists, Akhil Amar and Jack Balkin and others, who maybe run against the grain a little bit in that score. So this isn't at all uniform, and I think as you'll see how the court has approached the issues, it's not been labeled originalism until recently, but the core elements of what's now called originalism show up again and again. So finally, what kind of a claim is this? And the first sentence that you'll see here on the slide is really what I'm talking about today. What does the court say it's doing? That would be a pretty objective thing. You can read the words the court says. The court often sets out its interpretive principles. More recently, pretty consistently, in sort of a statement of the rule or a statement of our principles, and then an application of those. there's a period of time in the court's history where it regularly did not expressly state what the interpretive principles were. It simply either dove into direct application of the text, or it directly applied cases that had been applying that text without grappling with the text itself. So I'm not going to answer the second question. What in fact is the court doing? Is the court saying it's doing one thing and doing something else? Is it negligently or intentionally engaging in something different than what it says? Academics are much better at those kinds of arguments and discussions than sitting judges. And certainly without briefing an argument, I'm not going to be interested in trying to relitigate cases that have been decided previously by my court. And then finally, the last question, what should the court be doing, is also a separate question, also really beyond the scope of my narrow question here today. That'd be more of a normative question about philosophical and moral considerations, about how courts, what objectives they should be aiming at in their interpretation. So with that out of the way, we can get to what is my claim and what am I trying to defend here today? Originalism best describes how the North Dakota Supreme Court has described its interpretive method for the North Dakota Constitution. So how did I attempt to answer this question? And I'll cover this at high level. It's in my paper. I try to show my work. I don't want my readers to wonder if I'm cherry-picking cases that support a preconceived notion. I want you as a reader, if you're interested or skeptical, to be able to reproduce my work, to replicate my searches, and to come to your own conclusions. So I tried to map out what I think is an objective selection of cases, understanding that the North Dakota Supreme Court has more than 17,000 published opinions. I can't read them all. I could ask my law clerk to read them all, but they'd promptly object to that as well. Even narrowing that down to the cases that cite or mention the Constitution, we're looking at over 1,500 cases, which is still an insurmountable hill to climb. And so what I did here was, using Lexis and Westlaw searches as a starting point, identified some keywords that helped me find which cases mention the Constitution. And because of optical character recognition and different citation styles, you have to use a variety of abbreviations for Constitution. You have to use a variety of phrasings. Organic law is sometimes used. Things like that that aren't direct citations, and they don't often show up in the they don't always show up in the citations in Lexis and Westlaw. So I put those together. I divided the time period into two, broke it at 1950, so that we could look to see whether citations patterns were different in the early years of statehood as compared to today. And I took those well over 1,000 cases and said, let's use this Westlaw search to sort by most cited. The theory being, if there are cases and opinions that our court has regularly cited, they're much more likely to be a well-vetted statement of what the court's principles are. And if it's an outlier statement or an unusual or idiosyncratic statement, it's probably not something that the court's as likely to cite and to repeat. And so I filtered those down to the top 50 or so in each time period, and I had to find a breakpoint, and it's all labeled out. But one little nuance point, though, Westlaw's most cited search will aggregate brief citations in briefs, citations in secondary sources like law reviews, and no offense to any law review board members, but I wasn't interested in which cases were cited by the law review. I wanted to know what the court thought its method was. And so on top of all of that, and I think that's about enough detail on that topic, I layered on anything that Westlaw had put under its keynotes related to constitutional interpretation, whether they were cited one time, no times, 50 times. I added those to the pile because some other person, not me, had determined that those were relevant to how the North Dakota Supreme Court interprets its constitution. So that's my set of cases. And so what we did there was classify those. According to, do they say anything about fixation? Do they say anything about constraint? And do they say anything about original meaning and how that's determined? And so just to summarize on the fixation classification of these cases, among those pre-1950 search results, I was only able to classify 13 out of 78 cases as including statements that appeared to agree with the fixation principle. I found one that appeared to disagree with that fixation principle, and 64 were silent and couldn't be fairly classified. And then among the post-1950 search results, 13 out of 115 appeared to agree with fixation, 3 disagreed, and 99 were silent. So we'll get into why so many cases are silent, but at least at first cut, those that you could classify appeared to be significantly in favor of supporting fixation. And I want to talk about a few of those illustrative cases to illustrate what I'm talking about here. So first case, pretty old one, you'll see 1904, Berry versus Truax. Berry case stands for the proposition that right to jury trial that's in our Declaration of Rights was fixed in all its essential elements when it became a part of the 1889 Constitution. And so the way the court described this as, the right of trial by jury is a right well known and commonly understood at the time of its adoption, and it is the right so understood which is secured by it. And we have several later jury trial cases that follow Berry versus Truax, and they focus very intently on how did the people understand the right to jury trial to work in 1889 when they locked it into their constitution. And the facts of the Berry case are pretty simple. The guy was tried and convicted for murder. He appealed, got it reversed. He had a second trial. The jury hung. The state then wanted to move it to a different county. And what the court determined was, it was the understanding of the people in North Dakota when they adopted the right to jury trial that you could move venue of a criminal jury trial to another county if it was required to have a fair and impartial jury to try the case. And so that was part of the jury trial as it was understood, and that was retained as part of the jury, the right to a jury trial fixed into the Constitution. A couple of others that more directly and elaborately talk about the fixation principle. Anybody who's been to Dunseith knows what this is. Dunseith is a small little town in northern North Dakota, and like many small towns in North Dakota, they have unusual animal statues to attract roadside tourists. This case isn't about the turtle near Dunseith, but it's about prohibition, which is similarly quaint to our modern ears, but taxpayer suit by Adrian Egbert, and he sued the city of Dunseith because the city wanted to establish a municipal liquor store. And so he's arguing under the gift clause that it's prohibited from engaging in the enterprise of the liquor business. And what's interesting about this case is the gift clause was amended a couple of times in the teens. And it was amended in 1918 to read in part that the state, any county or city, may make internal improvements and may engage in any industry, enterprise, or business not prohibited by Article 20 of the Constitution. So you hear that incorporation by reference. You have to ask, what's Article 20 of the Constitution? Well, Article 20 was adopted by separate vote in 1889 to prohibit alcohol, manufacture, or sale of alcohol in the state. It had been repealed in 1932. And so this Egbert case is 1946. So the question is, what does that reference to a repealed article in the Constitution mean? And so the court, relying on that 1918 amendment, it inferred that the intent of the people was, as it stated, the proponents of the amendment and those who voted for its adoption was to permit the state and municipalities to engage in business enterprises. And so there wasn't an express intent about what the effect of any future repeal of Article 20 might be, but it applied the canons of construction to say that finding room for difference of opinion, a specific reference to another provision has the same effect as if the reference provision had been incorporated bodily into the adopting statute. So that's a pretty standard rule for statutory interpretation. The court's conclusion here is that the intent of the and purpose of the people when they adopted this amendment in 1918 was to include the text of 20 into the gift clause by reference, and the repeal of 20 didn't implicitly erase out the repeal of then Section 185. It didn't erase that provision of the gift clause. So that's still in the Constitution today. There's still a reference to Article 20, which has been gone from the Constitution for 90 years now, nearly. And it still means as if that text from the Prohibition Amendment was still in the Constitution, and cities still cannot own and operate liquor establishments. So Dunseith does not have a liquor store today. One last case on fixation. I believe he pronounced his name Reimers, but I took German in high school, and I always want to say Reimers. So if anybody happens to know exactly how he pronounces his name, I'd be interested. But he's a regular litigant in front of the court, and in one of his cases, he was charged with following too closely. And you can find some of these. This is the actual citation, I believe. You can find some of his citations still in our court files. Punishable by $20 fine. And he sought a writ because the municipal court refused his motion to transfer the case to district court for a jury trial on this $20 traffic offense. The question presented to the North Dakota Supreme Court was, does the jury trial right under the Constitution guarantee him a right to a jury trial for a violation of a non-criminal municipal traffic offense that is punished by only a $20 fine? The divided court, and it was divided 3-2 on this question, engaged in original meaning about what meaning was fixed at the time of statehood. Now this time, again, it's the jury trial amendment that was at issue in Berry. The court put some additional emphasis on the word remain in the provision. The majority emphasized that Section 13 says the right shall, quote, remain inviolate, and used that as somewhat of a textual hook to say that whatever it was at that point in time, that's what it would be going into the future. And so, ultimately, the court said that he had the right to have a jury trial, even for a municipal, fairly low-level offense like that traffic offense that he was charged with. Just a couple of illustrative, consistent cases, because I do want to at least highlight somewhat of the spectrum of cases that I found, and some interesting formulations of how the court has nodded to and applied this fixation principle. In Newman versus Hella, this is a Harold Newman of Newman Signs. If you've driven in North Dakota, you've seen Newman signs all over the place. He brought a taxpayer suit. He didn't think the state should spend money on acquiring advertising rights along Interstate 94 when it was being built. And so the question was whether the control of billboards and advertising adjacent to highway rights-of-way could be considered part of a public highway at that time, because we had a special constitutional fund that could only be spent on maintenance and improvement of highways. And so the court looked at prior statutes that authorized the highway department and gave it the duty to remove advertising signs that were in the right-of-way and that were abutting the right-of-way. The court concluded that the understanding of the amendment would have been to include signage along the highway within the highway purposes that were at issue in that case. And as the court said, the people froze into a constitutional provision, a subject already covered by statute. Twitchell versus Hall, a little bit older reference, but talking about adopting by reference for all time. Again, a pretty hard and fast fixation kind of reference. Fettig was, again, a jury trial case focusing on the contemporaneous history at the time of adoption, and that's the only way, the only mode of construction that you could determine the intent of the framers and what was their purpose and effect. Finally, that Sherwood case, just briefly, they were focusing on the history of a 1912 amendment in a 1992 case. Again, going back an awful long way to figure out what would the people have meant by a constitutional provision that had a requirement that any disposition of state school lands has to be by auction at the county courthouse, and how that interacted with a statute allowing sale in lieu of condemnation when a government purpose, a public purpose, was the reason for the transfer of the school lands, in that case, construction of an airport. So the focus there was on the implementing legislation immediately after the constitutional amendment in 1912 and how that reflected on the understanding of the people who voted to ratify that provision. So now you've always been wondering, I'm sure, well, what are these inconsistent cases, and what do those have to say? Because Tufte up there, he says, it's 13-1, or it's pretty lopsided, but there are some going the other way, and I think we have to take a close look at what the courts said in those cases. Norton is probably the most striking phrasing that, to my knowledge, can only be found in that case. And again, I wasn't able to read every single case in the North Dakota Supreme Court, but 1934, the Constitution is a living, breathing, vital instrument adaptable to the needs of the day and was so intended by the people when adopted. That doesn't sound much like originalism there. I'll leave it to the reader if you want to go see what that court actually did and whether and how they applied that. I'm not going to engage in trying to rebut each of these inconsistent cases to prove a point, because remember, my point is, what does the court say it's doing? That's what that court said it should be doing or is doing. And if you're interested in cases on either side about what they're actually doing, you have the citations. You're welcome to take a look. Just a couple others here on fixation and what appears to be inconsistent. We have Furch, Cass County case in 1953, talking about growing complexity and integration of society, that the concept of public use naturally expands in proportion. Not real consistent with fixation there. Tormashi versus Helle, that's quoting a Nebraska Supreme Court case where they're talking about provisions of Constitution that are constantly expanded and enlarged by construction to meet the advancing affairs of men. And then finally, a little bit more recent case in 1986, it's quoting its own, partially quoting its own prior opinion, that it had once stated the provision must be interpreted in light of the superior rights of the public and the necessities of the occasion. So there is some material to work with on the other side and some interesting contrary statements. But what about all those silent cases? And just to give you some idea of what I learned in reading all those cases that I wasn't able to classify, a lot of cases mention the Constitution in passing. There's a set that mention it purely for jurisdiction, but there's no constitutional issue in play. It might be a personal or subject matter jurisdiction question on appeal. There's a whole bunch of them that cite the Constitution without quoting it, without really applying it. Some that are in the Fourth Amendment or equal protection or otherwise, that just dive right into a case that's on point, and it's a very short opinion, and there's no need in that court's opinion or analysis to elaborate or interpret the text of the provision that's at issue. They felt like a prior case had decided the question. And secondarily, on the fixation point, it's, I think, fair to read some of these cases as this provision was enacted just a few years ago. It almost goes without saying that it means today what it meant 3 years ago when it was adopted, that fixation just doesn't come up very salient, doesn't become very salient for recently adopted provisions. So, finally, a little note on what Thomas Cooley has had to say about fixation. I mentioned Thomas Cooley because he spoke to the Constitutional Convention. He was the best-known scholar of state constitutions at the time that ours was drafted. And his treatise, I believe, was in the, well, it says there in the citation, the fifth edition in 1883, prior to adoption of our state constitution. So what he says would have had a little extra persuasive effect on how our court and how our ratifying public would have thought constitutions are supposed to be interpreted. I believe Cooley has been cited by our state Supreme Court on the order of 300 or 400 times. I didn't collect that number. He was cited by the U.S. Supreme Court even more times than that. So not an idiosyncratic cite. And so what he says is, the bolded part, the meaning of the Constitution is fixed when it's adopted, and it's not different at any subsequent time when a court has occasion to pass on it. So moving on to constraint here, and I do intend to leave some time for questions if there are any at the end. But constraint is at minimum that constitutional actors in any of the three branches must act consistent with original meaning. And so, you know, a court would state agreement with the constraint principle if its opinions state that it must act and require its coordinate branches to act within the limits of what it understands the original meaning of the constitutional text to be. And of course, any doctrines or implementing rules ought to be fairly traceable to the original meaning of the text. So we're not just talking about cases where the court is upholding a facial challenge and striking down a statute. We're talking about both upholding laws that are clearly constitutional and striking down laws that the court believes contradict a provision of the Constitution. And on the statistics on that, similarly lopsided. Pre-1950, I had 38 out of 78 indicating agreement with constraint. So a few more that you're able to classify there. One that appeared to indicate disagreement, and 39 as silent. Post-1950, I had 29 out of 115 state agreement with the current constraint principle, one state disagreement, and 85 appeared to be silent or not able to be classified. So a few illustrative cases there, what kinds of cases and statements that I'm referring to when I think this court has said that it's applying something that looks like the constraint principle. Again, starting with an early case, Land Board versus Macmillan, you see a picture of the, as it was then called, the State Normal School in Valley City, North Dakota. The court said, when the Constitution speaks, its voice is supreme, and its mandates are to be obeyed by all departments and all officers of state government. And here, the second quote I have on the slide, they're quoting Cooley for the true rule, that contemporary construction can never abrogate the text, it can never fritter away its obvious sense, it can never narrow down its true limitations, and it can never enlarge its natural boundaries. So here the court had declared unconstitutional a statute that authorized investment of the permanent school fund in certain state bonds, and essentially the state had an argument that said it was a bond for this purpose but not for that purpose, and the court didn't find that argument terribly persuasive. And it interpreted the debt limit provision to prohibit the investment, even though that it acknowledged the legislature had intended for that investment to be authorized by the statute at issue in that case. Northwestern Bell versus Wentz, a 1960 case here. We have challenges to a statute that allowed the state to pay utilities, including Northwestern Bell, the telephone company at the time, relocation costs when they're expanding or changing roads. The state authorized payment of costs to move the phone and power lines. There's a gift clause challenge there, that if the state had no legal obligation to move those, then the challenger said that it would be a prohibited gift under the gift clause to pay that expenditure. And so here we have the court saying that the Constitution is paramount and it's a self-imposed restraint on the people in the exercise of their government sovereign powers, either themselves or through their agents in the legislature. Pretty direct statement, I think, there of constraint. This is actually, I think, the only case I cite from a time when I was on the court, just to illustrate the constraint and fixation and constraint both can come up in recently adopted constitutional provisions. But here I cite this in part because the usual formulation, and many of these are facial challenges, but not always, is that a statute's in conflict with the Constitution and it's void from the beginning as if it was never enacted because the legislature lacked the power to enact it. And that issue in the Strom case was a statute that was constitutional when enacted, and the Victims' Rights Amendment became part of our state constitution in 2016. And so when the legislature does that, you call that an implied repeal. When the people do that and enact a constitutional provision that conflicts with existing statutes, it's similar to an implied repeal, but the way the court phrased it in that case was to render those inconsistent portions inoperative and unenforceable. And so those were effectively abrogated from that statute. So a couple of quick highlights on other consistent cases. I try to span a range of time to show at least what I think is a pretty consistent articulation of some of these principles along the way. We have Standish versus Nomlin back in 1893, where the court says, if the legislature in any act disregard the mandate, it's the duty of the court to nullify the act. And the fact that the abortive legislation may be highly beneficial and salutary in its nature can in no manner control that duty. Again, we have the Constitution limiting the power of the people's agents, especially the legislature, in State versus Taylor. We have Langer articulating that it's equally obligatory on the court and on the legislature, and it's the duty of the court to uphold it in its plain words and meaning, so long as the court has imposed on it the sworn duty to uphold the Constitution. So these go back to those early cases, and they continue in more recent cases involving Reimers and others. But we do have a couple of inconsistent cases here that I think you also, again, have to acknowledge. And one of them is Norton again, the one that I mentioned is inconsistent with fixation. And so here we have a different piece of Norton, a different statement in Norton, where it says the Constitution was not a hard and fast piece of legislation, but a declaration of principles of government for the protection and guidance of those upon whose shoulders the government rested. This doesn't sound quite the same articulation of constraint or mandate or hard limits, but of guidance and declaration of principles. Definitely a different flavor. If you're interested in that Norton case, I think this case has echoes of the advice that Cooley gave at the Constitutional Convention. He articulates some very similar sounding themes in what he said, and those are at the Journal of the Constitutional Convention at page 66 and 67. Finally, we do have a more recent case, McCarney versus Meyer, in a selection case. And in that case, they were talking about the requirements for referendum petitions, and the constitutional provision at issue says, each elector signing a petition shall also write in the date of signing and his post office address. And so the court took that provision, and it reasoned that it wouldn't promote the purpose of the Constitution to exclude a signature just because the signer failed to comply strictly with a technical requirement where the sample provided misled the signer to believe that the city and state, such as, in that case, Bowman, North Dakota, was a sufficient designation of a post office address. So the instructions and the forms that the Secretary of State gave out showed as the example post office address a bare city and state. And the court didn't read that as being a post office address because you can't deliver mail through the post office with just a city and state. But regardless, it went on to excuse strict compliance with a technical requirement. So I think one has to fairly categorize that as inconsistent with the idea that the Constitution constrains government actors in that situation. So those are the two inconsistent cases. We'll talk a little bit about what does the court mean when it talks about meaning? And it sounds like a bit of a tail-chasing argument, but I hope we'll get to a point of articulating what the court has said about this. So we have the court talking about two-sided communication. Any communication, it's implicit in what the word means. You have speakers and listeners, you have readers and writers, framers and citizens who vote to either reject or adopt a constitutional provision. And so the court phrases this in different ways, but it often says its primary duty is to determine the meaning intended by the framers and adopters. And so we expect, and I think it's generally true, that competent users of language will arrive at the same meaning. And if not, if the framers and the adopters have a different idea of meaning, we've got a failure to communicate that we'll have to resolve in some way. To my knowledge, our North Dakota Supreme Court has never found a situation where it believed the framers and the adopters had a different understanding of what a provision meant. But my thought there, and I think the broad theme of the cases is it's the intent of the adopters that matters. If ever there's a potential conflict, it's what the people reasonably would have thought that meant, the people that voted to put that in the Constitution. I'll just gloss over this briefly. If you're interested in the topic of the law of interpretation, there's a fairly recent article on the broader topic that dives into some of these two-sided communications issues and what it means to read something as a legal instrument versus seeking plain meaning or ordinary meaning, how you bring in structure in terms of art. But one of the useful takeaways, I think, from this piece is to remind yourself that it's not an exercise of what do these words mean, but it's an exercise of what law did this instrument make. And sometimes, in order to answer that question, you have to think about what was the law the day before this provision was adopted, and what was the law the day after, and what change did that enactment, that amendment, that new provision affect in the overall system of law. And that'll help you understand what law did the instrument make. So a couple of cases here. Miller versus Taylor related to what was then called a state normal school, now called Minot State University. The court there grapples with the possibility that the framers and the voters of a provision might have had a different meaning. So this case turns on whether there's a technical difference between a constitutional revision and a constitutional amendment. Because there's a provision in the state constitution at the time of this decision that sets out the state hospital and state colleges and the capitol and the state prison and various state institutions and says where they have to be. And the history of it's pretty interesting in sort of the regional divide and trying to secure some state jobs and state investment in different parts of the state. And so this provision relates to that argument and how it was settled. And the argument to the court here in this case was that a revision had a technical meaning that related to changing the Constitution by convention, and because this particular amendment at issue here was adopted through a legislative resolution that put it on the ballot, they said it wasn't a revision, and therefore the proposed changes to the State College in Minot were not consistent with that constitutional provision. But the court looked to what the plain and ordinary meaning of how people use the terms revision and amendment. They looked at both sort of the legislative history of that resolution, and they looked at how the people in the public use those terms, and they found that they were used commonly interchangeably, and they meant the same thing. And so if there was a technical legal meaning to revision as opposed to amendment, it was the popular sense or common meaning that controlled in that case. Recall North Dakota, recall ND versus Jaeger, again, a more recent case, a case that follows more of what I refer to as our house style on the court in terms of how opinions are structured and kind of block quoting some of these canons and interpretive principles. You'll see a couple of them here on the slide, that the court's seeking the intent and purpose of the people adopting the constitutional statement. And that's by reference to the plain, ordinary, and commonly understood meaning. Again, phrases that have evolved a bit over time, but generally the same formulation going back to statehood. And here, this was the case that was mentioned earlier today about attempting to recall a U.S. senator. And the court essentially said the proposed interpretation that you're bringing to the court is untenable because it would have added words to what was actually in the Constitution. And so the court felt it was limited by the words of the language in the Constitution itself and couldn't elaborate or adopt the proposed construction by the challengers in that case. So are there practical problems? Anybody know what movie that is? Anybody in the room? It's even sort of before my time. Okay. Remotely, if anybody wants to chime in, I don't have a prize, but if anybody in the comments, I'll try to get the remote listeners engaged. We haven't had failures to communicate. We generally do have pretty competent users of language when we write and adopt provisions. But like in contracts, like in other areas of law, the court's generally constructing a hypothetical reasonable person who's out there reasonably informed, voting on this provision and what they would have understood the language to mean and do as a legal matter. So if you're an advocate, and several of you are here, and those of you listening online so you can get CLE credits, how do you reach these people? Because these are the people that as a trained lawyer, and if you're addressing a case in a district court or on appeal, you want to think about how can you reach your audience? And you know, there's been some interesting commentary recently how in the U.S. Supreme Court, advocates are gravitating to tailor briefs to certain individual justices and interpretive approaches that they think might work. And so you have Justice Kagan saying a few years ago that we're all textualists now, and you have commentators talking about a Gorsuch brief that some sort of more politically progressive advocates, even though they might prefer a sort of a policy-themed argument that talks about outcomes and consequences, they might go to dictionaries and close grammatical analysis and punctuation and something that they perceive as something that a Justice Gorsuch, that might resonate with him. And we've seen a couple of those kinds of opinions from him this last session that are very grammar and structure focused. So as an advocate, I think what you can take away from my talk is what's worked in the past and what do you want to make sure you don't overlook in constructing your arguments to the court today. And so, just as a preliminary matter, of course, if you're in the trial courts, you have to preserve these issues, and you have to raise them and brief them to the trial courts, especially if it's a facial challenge, because our appellate rules say, Rule 44, and similarly for municipal court issues under statute, if you don't raise it in the district court, it's waived, and you have to give notice to the Attorney General so that the state can participate and defend the statute if the state chooses to, and it often will. But assuming you've preserved the argument and you're still able to make it to the court, we'll start with the text. Way too many advocates skip right past what is the language of the provision that I'm arguing under, and they jump right to a case and apply the case because, legal education, certainly in my day, and I think largely to this day, it's very case law focused because there's a lot of great things you can learn from reading cases. Certainly my colleague's case is probably more so than mine. But there's an initial step. Those opinions are often interpreting statutes and constitutional provisions. And so if the cases turn on doctrine developed in federal courts or in other state courts, first tell us as a court, at least I'm interested in this question, is the language different? Is there a meaningful difference in the different language that applies to your case? The court has to determine whether the text is ambiguous because sometimes that opens up additional sources that it consider. But the court has said many times that the text is ambiguous if, quote, good arguments can be made for two contrary positions. Not two rational arguments, but good arguments is frequently the formulation. So starting with the text, of course, you do have to ask yourself, I'm a modern reader in the year 2020. Do I need to put myself in the shoes of the time and place that the provision was enacted? I might not know what I don't know about what these words meant. I've referred to the state normal school a couple of times. I don't know how many of you know what a normal school is. I didn't until I read some of those cases. It's a teacher's college. It's a college for educating teachers to be educators. And if you break down the term normal school and you figure out what normal means and you figure out what school means, you're not going to arrive at what normal school meant to that court or what it meant to the people who put those terms in the Constitution. So you might use dictionaries. You might not use that one necessarily, although the court has used that one quite a bit, because that's probably the one that somebody gave you when you went off to college, and it's the one that's handy and it's on your desk. But if a provision's adopted in 1918, is that the right dictionary to consult? It might be perfectly good, but it might not be. So I'd suggest if you're citing a dictionary, because maybe there's a reason to cite a dictionary in your argument, find one close in time to the enactment or adoption of the provision at issue. Pre-1924, everything's out of copyright. And so first edition of Black's Law Dictionary, 1891, that's pretty close in time to the state constitution. Maybe that'd be a good one to just take a look at least to see if it sheds some light on your argument. You've got old Webster's 1886, also, again, out of copyright. Books.google.com, a variety of other sources. You can find these. You don't have to go hunting through the stacks at the law library to get these things anymore. We really are in a golden age for being able to do easy research if you're so inclined. Don't overlook terms of art. As I mentioned, normal school, but some of these other terms are treated, the unit of interpretation is not the word, but it's the phrase, or it's a compound, some sort of unit that has a specialized meaning. And so don't overlook the possibility that there's specialized meaning that you might find in those law dictionaries, but you might have to do some more digging to find out what the term would have meant to the people who adopted it. So a lot of times, like the right of trial by jury, which is treated like a term of art, is going to carry a lot of baggage from territorial code, from prior court decisions, and from other ways that people might form understandings about what those terms mean. All right, and treatises, I already mentioned Cooley and sort of why he's important. Again, these are available online in PDF if you want to check. One useful thing that I've found in at least looking at provisions from the original Constitution is that he not only discusses what many of these state constitutional provisions mean, and I'm not just talking about the Declaration of Rights, but I'm talking about the taxation provisions, the debt limit provisions, the separation of powers. He collects in footnotes numerous cases. He was a justice on the Michigan Supreme Court and dean of the Michigan Law School for quite a number of years. Those can be interesting and useful jumping off points if you need to find, from a historical perspective, a provision that hasn't gotten a gloss in our case law. Of course, if there are court opinions from North Dakota that interpret the provision you're working with, obviously you address those. I'm trying to just cover some of the things that I think people sometimes overlook, and specifically what our court has relied on. As I said, Cooley's been cited hundreds of times by the North Dakota Supreme Court over the years. The records of the convention, they're pretty sparse. There's not a lot of debate there. We don't have the equivalent of the Federalist Papers or detailed debates and amendments. Mr. Samuelson very ably covered some of the shortcomings and the limitations of what we do have. The committee work was entirely unrecorded. There is some press coverage. Most of it's not detailed. These newspapers of the day were typically 8 pages, often weeklies. So there just wasn't the inches of space to engage in much detail at all. Up until 1965, the Secretary of State published these publicity pamphlets. The courts relied on these several times to form an understanding of how the people would have understood a particular provision at issue. And so if you're looking at constitutional texts that came in before 1965, you might be able to find those and maybe develop some additional nuance or some understanding about what the people might have meant. You might also want to consider, at least as to the individual rights, that in 1889, the Bill of Rights had not been incorporated against the states. And so you have to remind yourself as a modern reader who's used to the federal constitution being applied directly to the states that when similar language, often not identical, but often similar language, was put into the state constitution, nobody thought the federal constitution applied. So that might change your idea about how people might have thought some of those provisions operated. And so that's part of looking to the history of the time when a provision is enacted to consider what kind of problems they were trying to address with that change. And I'll close with sort of a note of caution. We've got some great advocates in this state, a lot of people that do a really wonderful job. A lot of lawyers have clients who have limited resources, and they can invest endless hours of research and drafting time if they've got a private pay lawyer. And so I understand, as an advocate, sometimes your client just doesn't have the resources for you to really do all the research you'd maybe like to do. And so with that context, sometimes we get arguments that are just barely a citation of the Constitution, and please let me win because you can is the gist of the argument. That it's not really providing authority or reasoned analysis or giving us any textual hook, but essentially saying you can interpret the state constitution differently, so you should. And those are policy arguments that really haven't resonated with the court. I didn't find those types of arguments resonating with the court in the past. My suggestion is they're probably not likely to resonate, at least with this particular person who's on a court in the future. And so proceed with caution. If you're going to raise a constitutional issue, develop it and use some of the things that have worked in the past. My article is forthcoming, as was mentioned. I did want to mention that ndconst.org is something I've set up, and I'm collecting a lot of these sources that are, if you're interested in the history of our state constitution, if you're interested in developing and researching some of these issues, as I find them and as I use them in my day-to-day work, I collect them on here, and they're free for anybody to look at and to use to do your own articles or research or to perhaps aid in your advocacy along the way as well. With that, I'm interested in any questions or conversation.
Thank you, Justice Tufte. Ooh, that's loud. So first of all, a lot of people guessed Colhan Luke.
Yes, very good.
So good job to them. And then there was one question in the chat. So if a state has strong jurisprudence of interpreting the state constitution in a living and breathing document way, would the state Supreme Court have no obligation to continue that method for interpretation?
Okay, and I think I understand the question, and if somebody can ask a follow-up if I miss the mark. The way I think I would approach that question is if a court, a state high court, has a history and tradition of approaching issues in that living constitution kind of way, and the people adopt a provision into the constitution, knowing that that's the legal regime in which that provision will be interpreted, I think that implicitly adopts the methods that people expect the text to be interpreted according to. So I think you've got a lot of legitimacy for a court that can say when the people put this in, they understood we were going to be living constitutionalists with it, and to carry on with that. Then the people have essentially told the court that the bounds are a little looser, the constraint is looser, the maybe evolution of language is looser. You might have some political theory arguments for whether that's consistent with separation of powers or whether that's consistent with kind of democratic legitimacy, that the people don't know how language will evolve. And a common example, just to sort of connect to the U.S. Constitution, the term domestic violence appears in the U.S. Constitution. Now, none of us understands domestic violence to mean anything other than generally spousal abuse or, you know, somebody who is in a close, intimate relationship. But it's talking about insurrection in the U.S. Constitution, and the language has evolved in that period of time. And I would really find it interesting if somebody were to decide our future government is going to be left to the whims of how language may evolve in unknown ways, and we choose to be bound by these unknown future evolutions of language. That's the common argument you hear against that. But I think the concise answer is, if the people are adopting a provision knowing that's the regime, then I think they're probably adopting the legal regime along with it. I hope that was responsive. If not, follow up.
One more question came into the chat. Since the adoption of the North Dakota Constitution was constrained by the Federal Enabling Act, how might the rights and liberties enumerated in the Enabling Act enter into the understanding of the enactment?
Well, and I'm not a scholar of the Enabling Act, so I wouldn't be able to put my fingertips in all the constraints that the questioner may have in mind. But certainly there was a parameter put on North Dakota and the other three states that their constitution had to comply with certain religious liberty requirements, certain Republican form of government type requirements. And I think the U.S. Congress could have decided that a state hadn't met the requirements if the adopted constitution didn't meet the parameters. As far as how that might inform the ratifying public's understanding of the meaning, that might be a useful source to take a look at, but I haven't really thought about that enough to give a full answer to that.
All right. Do we have any questions from the in-person audience?
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much, Justice Tufte.